Now, naturally, this has led to talk of Flair signing with AEW. I have no desire to see Ric Flair on television every week. I know he is good friends with Tony Khan, and Flair invited him to his wedding before AEW even existed. They had a friendship there. So they know each other. I'm sure Tony Khan would love to sign the Nature Boy. They already use other legends in a managerial role like Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard and Jake Roberts. I don't care to see it. I think one time for the visual of a Horseman reunion on camera with Arn and Tully, and maybe they bring J.J. Dillon back again. Okay, that would be cool. One time. I think bringing Flair in the way they did with Bret Hart for a one-shot would be fine. But as a regular performer, I have no desire to see that. And there's one more thing to keep in mind that you have to understand here, that a lot of people aren't really talking about. Dark Side of the Ring is doing an episode on the plane ride from hell later this year. That episode is very likely to paint Ric Flair in a very poor light. It is not going to be very kind to the Nature Boy. Even though it's something that happened almost 20 years ago, and we pretty much all know the story by now, but I know they got at least one of the flight attendants to talk and to open up on the show about what happened. It's not going to be pretty for a lot of people, but Ric Flair especially. It is not going to be pretty if they tell the full story. It is going to dredge up a lot of bad stuff. And if I'm Tony Khan, frankly, I'm not sure that I want to be associated with Ric Flair right now before that episode drops.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, dammit.
Solo Monster? Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Grand Slam week, everybody. We are only a few days away from seeing Kenny Omega wrestle Bryan Danielson in front of 18,000 people in New York City. And it looks like it's going to rain. But that's why they have a retractable roof. This is episode 722 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, September 19th, 2021. The audio that you heard there at the top was from Sound Off 716, exactly 6 weeks ago. 6 weeks ago. I told you this was going to happen. You heard it with your own two ears. One and a half, if Mick Foley happens to be listening to this. This episode of Dark Side of the Ring was going to be a complete shit show, and that is exactly what it was. And because it became an actual news story this week, I decided that it would be more appropriate to talk about it on the podcast instead of keeping it separate for YouTube, as all of the other reviews should be going forward. We're batting lead off with the plane ride from hell this week. And then I'm going to talk about the Dynamite and Rampage Grand Slam shows coming up from Arthur Ashe Stadium with my predictions. We have a new WWE champion. You know, years ago, this would have been the top story. And that's only number three, at best, this week. We have a new champion. His name is Big E. We'll talk about that. And I will give my thoughts on this NXT 2.0 reboot. I've got a lot to say about that. So it is a packed show. If you would like to support the podcast, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You will find the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, The Alabama Assassin Chris Young, Ostentatious Alan Carter, John Raging Mad Riffle, The Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, Caleb Showtime Lindley, The Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, The Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell, final boss, Brian Dudley. He and his wife, Megan, just welcomed their firstborn daughter, Brooklyn Dudley, into the world this week. Congrats to the both of them. I am partial to the name Brooklyn, so I think that is an awesome name. Much love and good health. And a very happy birthday to the man of the hour, the ambassador of disaster, Chase Wood, who turned 24 years old on Friday. Not only from yours truly, I hope it was a great day, but from your awesome parents as well, lover boy Larry and sweet Suzanne. They sound like a couple right off 1980s NWA television. But they also wanted to wish you a happy birthday. Chase, thank you for supporting me and supporting the show for all these years. And here's hoping that number 24 was even better than number 23. Hopefully you're still celebrating. If it were me and my birthday was on a Friday, I'd make that whole weekend my birthday. I would expect gifts and all kinds of stuff all weekend. So hopefully you are doing the same. Thank you for all of the nice messages. Some people thought I died this week. There was no Dynamite review on Wednesday. I kind of did one on Friday, even though that wasn't my intent. So if you wanted my thoughts on Dynamite, go back and watch the Rampage review on YouTube from the beginning. On Friday night, I talked about Dynamite first thing out. But I was under the weather this week, and I still don't sound great. So if I do sound any differently to any of you, I might not, but if I do, that's why. But I'm feeling better, so thank you for all the messages. I wanted to mention one more thing here. Very excited about this. This lifted my spirits this week when I got the news that House of Glory is back. Been waiting for this announcement for a while. I knew it was happening, just didn't know what the date was going to be, but we now know. Friday night, November the 12th, 8 p.m. bell time. If you are in the New York City area or anywhere close by, come on down. Tickets are on sale right now. This is going to be the first HOG event, the first Hog show in almost 2 years. The last show that we did was December of 2019. That was the last time that me and JD got in the booth together to call any of the matches. Almost 2 years. I hope I still remember what I'm doing. But November 12th is the date. That is the night before AEW Full Gear. Tickets are on sale right now, hogwrestling.net. You can go on there and buy tickets to the show. Hopefully I'll get to see some of you there. I haven't seen a lot of you guys in a very long time. I am excited. I am looking forward to seeing everybody there, getting back in the saddle. It's been a long time coming. So House of Glory is back on November 12th at the NYC Arena. And like I said, hopefully I'll see some of you there. Now, Dark Side of the Ring returned this week with the Plane Ride from Hell episode, which was the lowest rated episode of the series to date, but it was the one that caused the most controversy coming out of it. And Vice has put the entire episode on its YouTube channel with over 400,000 views so far and counting. So in the end, it'll be watched by a lot more. In case you do not have Vice, if you have not already seen the episode, you can simply go on YouTube and watch it there. If you want a frame of reference for what we're going to be talking about here. When I was done watching this episode, I was reminded of the Harvey Dent quote from one of my all-time favorite movies, The Dark Knight, when he said, "You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain." And that is especially true coming out of this episode. Nobody came out of this episode looking better than they did coming into it. Now, most of us knew the stories. I've talked about it on the podcast before, right? These stories have been told ad nauseum over the years of wrestlers getting boozed up and pilled up on the flight. Brock Lesnar fighting with Kurt Hennig. Sean Waltman cutting off Michael Hayes' ponytail. A drunken Goldust serenading his ex-wife over the loudspeaker. And Ric Flair, wearing nothing but his robe, harassing the flight attendants. But this time, we got to hear a first-person account from one of those flight attendants. This lady, Heidi Doyle. And to see and to hear her tell her story in her own words, it just hits differently. than just reading something on the internet or hearing somebody joke about it in a radio interview or a podcast interview. This added a new dimension to a story that has been told over and over again for a number of years, with additional details that perhaps some people had never heard before. Now, people talk about the plane ride from hell, right, as if it's an isolated incident. It's not. These things were commonplace back in the day, as evidenced by all of the people who couldn't even get their story straight on whether or not Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon were even on the flight. The documentary said that they were, which never made any sense to me, because if things had gotten out of hand to that degree, I don't think that there's any chance that happens with the boss and his wife on that plane. Now, since then, there have been people on the plane who swear that, in fact, Vince and Linda were not on the flight, and they were getting confused with a different one. And, you know, the producers got it wrong, which it looks like they may have. But then again, you have the other famous story of Vince McMahon wrestling Kurt Angle in the aisle of the plane and waking up Undertaker, who he's all groggy, and he wakes up and he looks over and he sees Kurt Angle. He sees this person on top of Vince McMahon thinking he's killing the boss. So he puts Kurt in a chokehold and almost chokes him unconscious. Kurt himself has referred to this as the plane ride from hell. That did not happen on the plane ride from hell. When this plane was in the air on its way back from the Insurrection pay-per-view in London, Kurt Angle was teaming with Chris Jericho against Hulk Hogan and The Rock at a house show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So unless Kurt Angle has mastered the science of cloning, and I think, you know, as far as wrestling matches go, this business would be a lot better off if we had a whole fucking army of Kurt Angle clones. Unless he's done that, he was not on the plane ride from hell. Insurrection, I think, was a Raw crew show. This is when they were divided, Raw crew, SmackDown crew. The SmackDown crew was back in the States, except for I think, just Triple H, who did work the pay-per-view, because I think at that time he was advertised for the show already and he was the champion, but then he lost the title. They made that last-second decision to put the title on Hogan at the most recent, was it Backlash, I guess it would have been. There was a pay-per-view a few weeks before this, and they kept Triple H on the tour anyway, because I guess they felt they needed him. But anyway, to my point, that was a different plane ride from hell. There have been lots of such plane rides. It is easy to get confused with stories of wrestlers H-bombing women and fondling them when they pass out, and cutting their clothes off or pulling their tops off, having their way with them, and then laughing about it after. And telling these stories years later in shoot interviews, like a badge of honor. They're not even trying to hide it. They openly tell these stories. That was the wrestling business. That includes a lot of your favorites. And probably a lot of mine, too. Some stories we know about. Think about all the ones that we don't. So to the people who say, you know, it's been 20 years, it's old news, who cares? Sometimes these things just need a little push into the mainstream, whether it's an article, whether it's a documentary in this case, and all of a sudden, what's old is new again. And it shines a whole new light on it. Look at what happened with the Allentown Morning Call story. On the 30th anniversary of Nancy Argentino's death. She died in 1983. Jimmy Snuka skated on that for decades. Until the paper did a story about it. And it led to charges being filed against him 30 years after the fact. You know, there was no social media back then. There was no 24-hour cable news cycle like there was back then. If there was, he might still be sitting in a prison cell right now. The only reason that the charges were even dropped against him is because they deemed that he wasn't, you know, in a state to be tried. By that point, he was old, he was sick, he died right after that. Had things been put in motion all those years ago, he probably would have been sitting in a cage for all these years. And so that's what happened here. The story was given new life It was given the documentary treatment, and it turned into a big news story this week, and the fallout from it may not be over yet. The flight came the day before the WWF changed from the World Wrestling Federation to World Wrestling Entertainment. It was the very next day they dropped the F. They had just wrapped up a UK exclusive pay-per-view show. They were about to head home, but there were weather issues back home, so they were delayed. And they sat on the tarmac on that plane for 7 hours. And we got to hear from Heidi, one of the flight attendants who was willing to come forward publicly with her story. She worked for SportJet, which routinely flew teams to, out of the Phoenix area all over the place. But, you know, teams like the Mariners and the Suns. I mean, the Mariners are in Seattle, but, you know, that's what they did on a routine basis. And when you have a charter flight like this, you don't have to deal with the general public. You don't have to deal with the bums like you and me. They have their own private jet. And while they sat there for all of those 7 hours, they went through not one, not two, but three liquor carts. That's before they even left the ground. So these guys were already hammered. Not to mention whatever else they were doing. When the flight was finally over, there were syringes laying around everywhere. Mike Chioda was interviewed for that. I mean, a lot of different people were interviewed for this, but Mike Chioda was interviewed for this. He didn't come off well either. Just laughing at everything. He talked about the boys sometimes giving people halcyon bombs, where they drop it in their drink behind their back to knock them out. I've talked about the halcyon stuff before. The Bulldogs were said to be notorious for it back in the day, as were the Rockers. They would do it. The Rockers would do it as a rib. Jannetty, he still gleefully talks about all those stories and all the women that they H-bombed. Brutus Beefcake, he said that the Rockers, they would drug him. They would have their way with him. And then Sean and Marty would throw him out of the hotel room naked into the hallway. Apparently this was commonplace. Rob Van Dam, I thought, out of everybody who was interviewed on this special, Rob Van Dam came across as the most sane, level-headed individual out of the whole bunch. I wouldn't say he comes across well either. There was an acceptance back then when it came to this kind of stuff. Even taking the sexual stuff, the sexual assault stuff, out of it, just for a second. There is nothing funny or cool about drugging somebody behind their back. Or, you know, roofying them, spiking their drink when they're not looking. Jim Ross in the episode flat out said, you know, back then, you never leave your drink. Never leave your drink uncovered. Because if you did, there was a pretty good chance it was going to be spiked. They covered Kurt Hennig, who loved to rib people, putting shaving cream on Brock Lesnar's head while he slept, and then smacking him on the head. You know, these two were friends, two Minnesota boys. But Kurt would always fuck with people, and Brock was not the person to fuck with, even back then. Brock didn't like that very much. The next thing you know, Lesnar is throwing this guy around the plane. They broke some seats. They slammed up against the emergency exit door. Now, they do make it clear in the episode that the door was not going to open. You know, at 30,000 feet in the air, that door wasn't opening. It was physically impossible. But they could have broken the fuselage, which is the body of the plane, and if they had to make an emergency landing, you know, as the flight attendant said, where are you going to land? You're over the Atlantic Ocean. Where are you supposed to land? So I'm sure that it was terrifying. Even if I knew, okay, that door is not going to open. If I saw Brock Lesnar enraged, tackling somebody into the emergency exit door, I'm going to panic too. Terry Runnels told a story about Lesnar exposing himself to her the previous night in the locker room. And she just no-sold it. Dustin was there when it happened. They were divorced by that point, but he was there. He saw it happen. And his reaction was to just follow her out the door, go over to her and say, hey, don't sell it. Just don't sell it. That's what a lot of the women were told over the years. Just don't sell it. Don't sell it. Pretend like it doesn't bother you. Don't sell it. And the producers put a little note in the episode that they tried to reach out to Lesnar for comment. They were unable to do so, which, Of course they were. I mean, they'd probably have to trek into the mountains of Saskatchewan to get a comment from him, and if they tried doing that, they probably wouldn't come back alive. But there's no excuses. There's no excuses. It's disgusting what he did. And he's talked about how drugged up he was back then during that period when he first broke into the wrestling business. He was very young. I think that was only a month after he debuted on TV. But that's not an excuse. You know, there's another story Jim Cornette has told over the years about Brock in his OVW days, grabbing Jim's wife. You know, I don't know if they were married at the time, but Jim is married to a former wrestler who was working for OVW at the time, this woman who, I think she went by the name of Sin. And, you know, he's told the story about the time that Lesnar grabbed his wife hard by the crotch on a gorilla press spot in the ring. Like, hard down there. And telling her in advance that he was going to do it, even though she had warned him, be careful down there, because she had just gotten her nether regions pierced. And I guess it was still sore. And he's like, I'm going to squeeze it. I'm going to squeeze it. And she's like, you better not. And sure enough, he supposedly clamped down as hard as he could. And she came back to the locker room and she was crying. And it led to a whole confrontation with Lesnar and Cornette. Just, you know, big, dumb jock, bully type shit that he was known for back then. And you hope that that's all it was him being young and stupid. But that's still no excuse to treat people like that. But when you're a big name, or in this case, he was a big up-and-coming name at that time. He wasn't even an established name at the time. But obviously, they saw money in him. When you're a big name like that, you're going to be given a lot more leeway than somebody who is more expendable. That's just how it is. And that's not just a wrestling thing, that's a sports thing, that's an entertainment thing, actors, musicians, you name it. If you are a big name and a big celebrity and you make people a lot of money, you're going to get a lot more chances to fuck up than the average person is going to. The wrestling business is no different. Shouldn't be that way. It's wildly fucked up. But that's how it's always been. Michael Hayes, he was on the flight. He randomly took a shot at JBL. Why the fuck would you do that? Apparently at that point, JBL was passed out. He was sleeping in his seat. Of all the people, JBL is actually quiet and you're going to wake him up? So he punches him. He's trying to open up. I guess Bradshaw got a cut on his head when he bladed in a match the night before. So he opened him up and Bradshaw's bleeding all over himself. And that leads to Bradshaw getting up and he knocks out Michael Hayes, which then led to Sean Waltman later on cutting off Michael Hayes' ponytail after he got H-bombed and he was passed out on the plane. He was totally out and Waltman chopped off his ponytail. And he was not happy about it. When he woke up and found out what happened, he wanted to know who did it, who did it. Next day at TV, X-Pac nailed the ponytail. It was either to a door or a wall in the locker room. JR saw it, he pulled it down, he threw it away. How Michael Hayes has survived in that company as long as he has is a mystery to me. He is a man-child who never grew up. Then again, I guess the person who runs the company is a man-child who never grew up. Now it all makes sense. Now that I say this out loud, it makes all the sense of the world. But that's what Hayes comes off as every one of these stories that I hear. And this is him as an agent and a producer, not even a wrestler. He's in a position of authority in this company. And he's acting like a man-child. He dresses up like one of the fucking lollipop kids from The Wizard of Oz. The guy made a drunken ass out of himself at Stephanie McMahon's wedding to the point where Linda McMahon had to snatch the microphone out of his hand and kick him off stage. People have been fired for far less than what Michael Hayes has done over the years. He's been suspended for using a racial slur. He's been demoted. But I guess his contributions are apparently so great, he's worth keeping employed. He's worth all the bad publicity over the years. Dustin. He grabbed the microphone. He started singing David Allen Coe's Pledging My Love to the PA over the PA system to his ex-wife, who was mortified. The flight attendant was trying to get her microphone away from him. He wouldn't give it back. Finally, Jim Ross comes out. I don't know where he was. He was up in first class, I guess. Wherever the fuck he was, he comes out. He has to go over to Dussett and say, sit your ass down. And then came the Ric Flair stuff. And Tommy Dreamer, who, in his defense of the Nature Boy, forever stained his name. Even though there were no stories of Dreamer being involved in anything bad here that we know of, he didn't have to say a thing. He didn't have to say a word. He chose to participate in this episode, which I'm sure is going to chase a lot of other people in the future away from participating in these episodes. He chose to participate and open his mouth and say the things that came out of his mouth, and now he is rightfully being raked over the coals for it, because what he said and the way in which he said it was fucking repulsive. And I'll get to that in a second. First, he explained that Flair, as a joke, would sometimes wear only his robe with nothing on underneath, and he would swing his dick around like a helicopter. Which is not a visual that I needed. And he complimented the size of what he called his hammer. Flair would have been 53 years old at the time of this flight, and he was still pulling this shit. Heidi says that she was in the kitchen area of the plane, which is a very narrow area. If you've ever been on an airplane, you know how narrow it can be back there by the bathroom and everything. And she was back there, and here comes Flair, wearing only his robe, and she says he wouldn't leave. And she alleges that he was spinning his dick around and he wanted her to touch it. And then she claims that he grabbed her hand and placed it on him. She says Goldust was the only one after minutes of this, went on for minutes. He was the only one to eventually come over and stop Flair. When the drunken American Idol wannabe is the only one to come over and save the day, there's a very big problem here. Now, Flair, for his part, he has denied over the years the allegations. And in fact, he was just on Renee Paquette's podcast, her Oral Sessions podcast. What a fucking name for a podcast for him to be on. And she brought up the fact that, hey, you know, Dark Side of the Ring is going to be covering the plane ride from hell in a few weeks. And this was Flair's response to Renee. This was just last week. He said, God, I've heard about it too, just when things are going good for me. Listen, you put me on your podcast after. We'll see how it plays out, because I was there, and I don't care whose name I gotta drop if the heat falls on me. I know who was where and what and who and what took place. I know the whole story. Ball's in your court, Nate. He claims he knows the whole story. Well, let's hear it. Let's hear it, because it's not looking too good. CarShield announced they have suspended their ad campaign with Flair. They've put a pause on it, and they are going to do their due diligence. CarShield is full of shit. It's not as if they didn't know what they were getting into when they got in bed with this guy. The robe stuff, stories like that, those have been around for years, dating back to the 80s when he was still the NWA champion. What do you think? He went naked in his robe only on WWE flights when he was 50 years old? That was happening for years. WWE did a Storytime episode on the network that was floating around again, on clips of which were floating around on social media this week. You know, they have that cartoon show, Storytime. They do the illustrated stories of ribs and all kinds of wrestler stories from over the years. It might have been the first episode that they ever did, I think, from the first season. I could be wrong about that. But anyway, they did a whole story on it as part of one of those Storytime shows that was not about the plane ride from hell. Some people think, oh, they was about the plane ride from hell. I can't believe they would do that. It was not about the plane ride from hell. This is what I mean about all this confusion that I've seen on social media this week. This is not the only time that Flair has done this. That episode was not specifically about the plane ride from hell. It was about Flair wearing his robe and getting naked in front of airline stewardesses and people in the past. It was not specifically about this flight. However, Peacock pulled the episode anyway. You cannot find it on there anymore. And I suspect that that episode will not be going back up, or if it does, they're going to cut out the Flair portion. But these are the exact comments that Tommy Dreamer, to go back to him, these are the exact comments that Tommy Dreamer made that got him into a lot of hot water this week. And I want to read them to you. I transcribed this myself. This is what he said. Ric Flair's not going to try to impose by force any sexual stuff onto anybody. He's just flaunting, styling and profiling, doing like the Ric Flair stuff where everybody's going to laugh about it. And then he rolls his eyes and he says, but obviously someone took offense to it. If that's how she felt, maybe she should have not taken a payout and went to the fullest extent of the law to then truly put this heinous person in jail. And the look on his face as he is saying this, my words do not do it justice. His face says more than the words that were actually coming out of his mouth. And then he said, I feel this is trying to portray someone as a sexual predator, and it's not. It's a joke. It's a gag. And today, 1,000% inappropriate. My hairstyle is inappropriate right now. I am somehow offending someone with my double ponytail. Why do I have two ponytails? And my answer is, I'm 50 years old, and I'm happy I have hair. But if you're asking me, he goes, I've hung out with Ric Flair. I've never seen him try to force his will against anybody. So those were the comments of one Tommy Dreamer, who, out of all the bozos on this plane who were doing stupid shit, is the one who comes out of this looking the worst and paying the heaviest price. Because, as I said, the stories about Flair behaving like a jackass have been around for years. Tommy Dreamer is somebody who actually had, and probably still with a lot of people has, a lot of respect. He is a well-respected veteran in the wrestling business. A lot of people like Tommy Dreamer, have worked with Tommy Dreamer, have a lot of positive things to say about Tommy Dreamer. That's what makes it so bad. Because a lot of those people watch this and their jaws dropped. I watch this and, you know, when I heard these comments and I saw him on camera and he made the comments that he made, my jaw was open. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe that as he was saying these words in his head, he thought it was a good idea to actually be saying the things that he was saying. I was gobsmacked. And that's what makes this so much worse. That's why he's coming out of this looking the worst. Nobody is shocked by the Flair stuff. They're shocked by what Tommy Dreamer had to say. And if Tommy Dreamer was on camera having said these comments in the mid-2000s, you know, let's say not long after this happened, it feels like a lifetime ago in the wrestling business. I mean, it still would have been bad, but it would not have had the same effect. It's the fact that these are fresh, new comments in the modern day, 2021, and he's being interviewed about this, and this is what he says. Tommy Dreamer has two daughters, twin girls. I wonder how he would feel if he found out that Ric Flair, not knowing who their father is, approached one of them in nothing but his robe and put their hand on his cock. If he would have a conversation with them after the fact and explain that, well, you know, that's just Ric being Ric. He's the nature boy. He didn't mean anything by it. Now, he could always claim that he didn't know the details, but he knew enough to acknowledge that there was a payout. He knew about that. And there was a lawsuit by both flight attendants a couple of years later and a settlement that came out of it. So he can't plead ignorance to that. Someone should tell Tommy Dreamer that the reason this one flight attendant didn't pursue charges when perhaps she would have is because her husband pushed for a settlement to spare their kids the embarrassment of a public trial. And the airline that she worked for allegedly pushed her to keep quiet because they handled flights for other sports teams, as I mentioned before, and it would be bad publicity, it would be bad for business if this turned into a whole spectacle. His comments were appalling. There is no defense of what Tommy Dreamer said on this episode. And evidently, Impact Wrestling agreed, because the next day, Ed Nordholm sent a company-wide email announcing that Dreamer was suspended indefinitely going forward. Dreamer has worked behind the scenes there for some time. He's worked in a creative capacity for Impact. Sometimes he wrestles for them. Nordholm said that Dreamer's comments were out of line with our core values as a company, and that he was asked to leave immediately, effective immediately, from Nashville, and was suspended going forward. He's lucky he wasn't fired straight away. He put Impact in an impossible position. They did what they had to do. And it looks like he may have lost his hosting gig on Busted Open Radio as well. On the show the day after, Dave LaGreca said that they are taking this very seriously and they do not condone the behavior displayed on the show. We'll see how that shakes out. Only about an hour ago, Dreamer issued this statement. He has issued a statement. So regarding my comments made on Dark Side of the Ring, it was never my intention to offend, hurt, or victim shame anyone. I understand my comments were insensitive and could trigger emotions in someone's own personal past. I do not condone sexual misconduct of any kind. I apologize to anyone I offended from the bottom of my heart. I am so sorry. Those are the words of Tommy Dreamer, who, honestly, there really was no other way for him to respond to this. To respond in any kind of defiant way or double down on those comments would have been career suicide for him. So these are the right comments to make. I hope he believes them. I hope he understands why people are so upset and understands why he came across so poorly in this episode. Scott Hall was another one on the plane. He claimed that Hennig H-bombed him, and he has no memory of anything else from the flight, but Heidi, the flight attendant, says that he was sitting in his seat. She had gone over to him. I think it might have been, she was maybe asking if he wanted something. I don't remember exactly what she was asking him, but he was sitting in his seat, and he looked up, and he said, he told her, he goes, "I'm going to lick you," and he tried to lick her. He may have licked her. But he certainly at least tried to, and then he passed out. He was so fucked up and so out of it that he passed out. After that, she had enough. She stayed in the kitchen area. She didn't get back up until that plane touched the ground. Hall was so out of it. People on the plane, when they landed and they saw him, they thought that he was dead. Justin Credible had to wheel him through the airport like a corpse. So Hennig was fired for his part in all of this. Hall was fired, which was inevitable from the moment he came back. All you had to do was start a countdown and take bets on which month he would be gone. JR said that he fined Dustin because he felt firing him would be too extreme. And when the producer asked him, you know, how come Ric Flair evaded any kind of punishment for this? JR went silent for a few seconds. Because, you know, he's friends with Rick. So he's thinking, how can I answer this diplomatically? Well, you know what? There is no diplomatic answer. He just told the truth, which is, good question, because he's a made man. He got a pass. And there it is. Flair is Teflon. For whatever reason, he gets a pass. Because, like with, you know, the Hogan tape, unless there was something that he did or that he said over all these years that was so horrible that it was caught on tape or on film and it leaked so people could hear it and see it with their own eyes, absent something like that, people just don't want to believe it. They hear the stories, but they just don't want to believe that this person could be capable of anything that is even remotely sinister. They don't want to believe that somebody they grew up idolizing could turn out to be such a flawed human being. Big stars and celebrities and athletes, they almost always get a pass. I'm not saying it's right. That's just the reality of how it is. Pro wrestling is no different. I can understand why Jim Ross is sick of talking about the plane ride from hell. He's ashamed of what happened on that plane. A bunch of grown men, a lot of them with children at home. acting like grade school kids. It's fucking pathetic. As I am recording this, WWE is kicking off a European tour. They're going to be in London tomorrow at the O2 Arena. And we know there won't be any alcohol served on those flights. Well, I mean, there might be if they're flying commercial, but I don't know if they even do charter flights for them anymore. But if they did, they wouldn't be served any liquor because they did away with that because of this flight. There won't be any stories like that coming out of this tour, I can promise you that. But the next episode coming up is on Chris Kanyon this Thursday, and that one is not likely to be very kind to Ric Flair either. If Tony Khan was thinking about bringing Ric Flair in, and I'm sure he was, now would be a good time to put those plans on hold indefinitely. Because this is not the kind of publicity that AEW needs when they're trying to build goodwill with their audience. Or any major company for that matter. It doesn't even have to be AEW. Any major company for that matter. Speaking of AEW, we are heading into the biggest week in the history of All Elite Wrestling. When they packed 14,000 people into the United Center in Chicago last month for CM Punk's first appearance in 7 years, that was the biggest night in company history. And I said at the time that they would top that 1 month later in New York with the debut of Bryan Danielson. Well, here we are 1 month later, and it is the debut of Bryan Danielson. It's just not the kind of debut I had expected. It is the in-ring debut of Bryan Danielson in AEW before the largest crowd in its history. As of today, as of this morning before I started recording, over 18,500 tickets have been sold. And by showtime with walk-up, that number probably is going to rise above 19,000. The little pissant t-shirt company, 2 years after it was formed, is going to pack in more people in New York City than WWE just did at Madison Square Garden for SmackDown. And that was a sellout. This is a bigger building. Would WWE have gotten 19,000 people in the garden for a sellout if the building was bigger? Who knows? But that is still quite the accomplishment. I'm not even taking away from WWE. I'm just using them as a frame of reference to show what a big deal that is for a company that has never even run the New York market before to come in and do something like this in a bigger building. New York is showing lots of love for AEW so far. WWE has so far sold 2,300 tickets for its very first event at the new UBS Arena on Long Island for Raw on November 29th. AEW in that same building for Dynamite 1 week later has already sold over 6,000 tickets. That comes per WrestleTix on Twitter. That's pretty impressive stuff for AEW. Now, you look at those numbers and you look at their TV ratings for Dynamite the past few weeks. They have been able to stay above 1 million viewers, 1.1 million. And for the fourth week in a row, they were the number one program on cable television on Wednesday. The timing could not be any better for them to hit a Grand Slam. And that is exactly what they are giving us this week. The Dynamite Grand Slam with the biggest match in AEW history between Bryan Danielson and Kenny Omega. You have a man on one side who appeared in the WrestleMania main event this year, just 5 months ago. He was in the WrestleMania main event. One of the best wrestlers on the planet over the past 15 years. Up against the AEW World Champion, former IWGP Champion. He too, one of the best wrestlers on the planet. You would expect this match to headline a pay-per-view, and it still might one day. This match is non-title. One day they might headline for a championship. Right now, Danielson, he's new. He isn't ranked. He said in his promo on TV on Wednesday, one day it is going to be about the title. Today is not that day. I came to AEW to face the best. Kenny Omega, I hear that you're the best. You're the one that I want to face. The fact is, it is their biggest show ever in front of their biggest live audience at a time where their television ratings and their demos and all that have never been higher. Now is the time to capitalize on that. That's why it is absolutely the right move to give this match away on TV the way they are this week. This is a big show. This is a pay-per-view being given away on TV. You have to have a worthy main event. I cannot think of another worthy main event bigger at the moment that they could possibly give people who know who Bryan Danielson is, to put them in the ring together one-on-one for the first time in well over a decade. I mean, I think they had a match once at a PWG show some number of years ago, but didn't mean nearly as much as this one is going to mean. You have to give the people the match that they want to see. And that's what they decided to do here on this show. Now, I said this on my Rampage stream on Friday night. The other reason I don't mind them giving the match away on TV this week, first, as I just said, this is basically a pay-per-view. The entire card is loaded from top to bottom. It's a bigger card than we just had it all out, if you include the matches that they're taping for Rampage on Friday. But when AEW signed CM Punk and Bryan Danielson, when they got both of them, it gave them a chance to go different ways with them. With Punk, they're taking it slow. They're going the more conservative route. They started him out against Darby Allin. This Friday, it's his second match. He's wrestling Powerhouse Hobbs. He is slowly working his way through the ranks before he even sniffs the championship. So while Punk is off doing that, Danielson came in, he goes straight after the top dog. I don't have an issue with that. We're getting Omega and Danielson on TV this week. How can I have an issue with that? Two big shows this week. I'm going to be live on YouTube immediately after both of them. First on Wednesday, it is the Dynamite Grand Slam. Let me run through the entire card. I'll give my thoughts and my predictions as we go along here. As I just mentioned, Kenny Omega one-on-one, non-title against Bryan Danielson. That is the big main event of the week. The only drawback that I can see to doing this match on TV and not pay-per-view are the ad breaks. We're going to have to sit through commercials. And the picture-in-picture stuff, which is not ideal. But if they give these two enough time, and they have to give these two at least 20 minutes. This could end up being the match of the year. The finish is what's going to be very interesting. I'm not worried about the match. The match, I'm sure, is going to be great. But AEW does not abuse disqualification finishes the way WWE does. In fact, they don't do them at all. I've only seen one DQ ever in an AEW match, and that was one fall in a 30-minute Iron Man match. That was the one between Pac and Omega. It's the only time I ever saw them do a DQ. So I think having the Elite run in for a DQ finish in a match like this with what should be their biggest TV audience ever watching this would be a huge disappointment. That would be a very big mistake. I think you need to either give the fans a winner, or what I would do, and by the way, if you give them a winner, I think it should be Omega. But you either give them a winner, or what I would do, and what I believe they're going to do, is go to a time limit draw. I said 20 minutes. They got to give them at least 20 minutes. 20 minutes would be, I think, a time limit draw in a match like this. That way, you protect both guys, keep things open-ended if you want to bring them back in a championship match later on. We already saw Omega lose on TV not too long ago to Christian Cage, just last month, in fact. Danielson, for him, it's his first match. It would not be ideal for him to go in there and lose. It wouldn't be a killer, but it's not something that I would do. I mean, Danielson is a made man. Danielson can lose to his next five matches, and it's not going to harm him that much. It's not what I would do. Just let them go out there and have a kick-ass match. Time runs out. That leaves people wanting more. The Elite comes down for the post-match beatdown. That brings out Christian, Jungle Boy, Luchasaurus to make the save. They brawl with Adam Cole and the Young Bucks either into the crowd or they brawl to the back. So now they're out of the picture. That puts more heat on their match coming up on Rampage on Friday because they're having a six-man tag. And then with Omega alone in the ring with Danielson, Hangman Page makes his return at Arthur Ashe, and he comes out to confront Kenny Omega. And now the wheels are in motion. Even though he had already lost, right? That's why he didn't get his title match. So there would have to be some kind of a story where, you know, he has to work his way back up to a championship match if Omega doesn't want to give him one. But the wheels then are set in motion to get to Hangman and Omega. Hopefully at Full Gear. for the championship. So that's my prediction on what we're going to see. Britt Baker defends the AEW women's title against Ruby Soho. I thought that their segment on Rampage Friday night was the best thing on the entire show. Otherwise, it was a very ho-hum episode. This stood out to me. And it didn't even stand out to me so much for anything that Britt Baker did. You know, she's turned into a very entertaining promo. But it was the best promo I've ever seen Ruby Soho cut in her entire life. And I realize, you know, I never had the chance to see her go out there in the ring like that with a mic in her hand. Basically by herself. No teammates, no lackeys, no flunkies, no nothing. And go out there and cut a promo for a big singles match. She never had that chance. As she said in her promo, she never had that chance in WWE. She was always part of the Riot Squad. She was part of a tag team. So this was my first time seeing her out there like that. And I thought she handled herself very well. I enjoyed the segment. I'm looking forward to the match. Do I expect a title change? Hell no. Britt Baker is going to retain her women's championship, as she should. As she should. She should not lose that title until they get to Baker and Thunder Rosa. They got to bring it back around to Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa. And I think they're waiting a year to do it. Last time we saw them, what was it, March? I believe it was March. When they had their Lights Out match on TV. It could be next March, next February or March, before we see them back in the ring together. But it's coming. And until that happens, Britt Baker needs to remain the AEW Women's Champion. We have Cody Rhodes one-on-one with Malakai Black. We saw Cody back on TV this week. For some reason, he was coming out through the crowd while Malakai was dealing with Rosario Dawson at ringside, who's a judge on the reality show that Cody is part of. She was at ringside wearing a Nightmare Family jacket. Malakai didn't like that very much, and she jumped on his back. I could do without all that. I'm looking forward to the match because I want to see if they have the balls to actually have Malakai Black win again. That would be the right outcome. He's my pick to win. I don't know if they have the guts to do it, but they should. He should not be losing this match. Sting and Darby Allin take on FTR. They did an angle on Dynamite where Sting, of all people, took a spike pile driver from Dash and Wheel or Dax, I guess. Dax and Cash. I have to get their names right. So we're going to get to see the match now. Sting, Darby, I can't imagine they lose here. FTR, probably the best opponents, safest opponents for Sting anyway, to be in the ring with. They're going to treat him like gold, believe me. So Sting and Darby go over. MJF against Brian Pillman Jr. They have built this up nicely over the last couple of weeks. I like the sit-down interview that Pillman did with Jim Ross on TV on Wednesday. I thought it was a strong segment to try to put things over and the sort of thing that JR, I think, would be very useful in going forward, doing segments like that, especially with younger talents who really have never had a chance to sit down and do a sit-down interview like this. Do I think he's winning? I don't. I don't think he has to. I think it's the biggest match of his life, Pillman. He can go out there, have a great match, and still lose. It's a big platform for him. It's a big stage. I think MJF goes over, and I said this on the stream on Friday, the only way I see MJF not winning this match, and it would be a fluky finish if he lost, only way that happens is if it is part of a split that happens on the show with him and Wardlow. I could see a situation because they've been teasing it and they've been teasing it, but they haven't pulled the trigger yet. Wardlow gets involved, or maybe MJF asks him for the Dynamite Diamond Ring, and who knows what happens, but it backfires. And it causes MJF to lose. And in the middle of the ring, in front of 19,000 people, there's MJF. He is yelling at Wardlow. He is insulting him. Maybe he even slaps him. And that right there could be where the switch gets flipped, and Wardlow, all of a sudden, he's had enough of this guy's shit, and he lays him out. And he leaves a hero in New York. You got a brand new babyface. That's the only way that MJF loses this match. If that doesn't happen on the show this week, then he's winning the match. CM Punk will be there. He'll be doing a live interview, building up his match against Will Hobbs. On Friday, It is the first ever two-hour edition of Rampage. Rampage Grand Slam is what they are calling it, which is being taped on Wednesday with Punk one-on-one against Hobbs. This is obviously going to be a win for CM Punk. Christian Cage and Jurassic Express take on Adam Cole and the Young Bucks. I'm picking Cole and the Bucks to go over. John Moxley and Eddie Kingston take on Minoru Suzuki and Lance Archer, Suzuki Goon, reunited in a lights out match. And they were playing up the whole Suzuki incident thing, as it was being called all week on social media, where his music got cut off. He didn't get his full entrance on Dynamite a couple of weeks ago. Well, he got it on Wednesday. He got the full Kazaninari entrance on Wednesday, and he'll probably get it again in New York. Maybe. But I like how they played off the whole thing. They realized some people were upset about that, and they turned it into a storyline about how he felt disrespected over that. I thought that was smart. Moxley and Kingston, they're my pick to win. Chris Jericho and Jake Hager take on Dan Lambert's Men of the Year, Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky. I think you got to give the win to Page and Sky. I think they benefit more from it. And for that, unless they just want to give people the feel-good moment of having Lambert's guys get beat. I mean, you could have Lambert's guys win and still have Lambert take a bump or get punched in the mouth when it's over. I think the heels win. Anna Jay one-on-one against Penelope Ford. I'm going with Anna Jay, always with Anna Jay. And an eight-man tag team match. Lucha Brothers, Santana, and Ortiz against Private Party, The Butcher, and The Blade. I'm going with the babyfaces. You can't have Santana and Ortiz come to New York and lose. So I think they and the Lucha Bros pick up the win. And that's a pretty stacked lineup there for both nights. This looks like to me like they're testing the waters with the two-hour format for Rampage Friday night from 10 p.m. to midnight. Almost certainly going to pull the overall rating down, but if TNT is happy with how it does, do not be surprised if this becomes a regular thing, although I don't know if that would extend to TBS when they switch networks in January. Don't forget, they don't have a lot of time left on TNT. As happy and elated as TNT seems to be with AEW, they put press releases out about them every week. They're losing them in a few months. Beginning of the year, everything is moving. Dynamite is moving. Rampage is moving over to TBS. TNT is supposedly going to be getting quarterly AEW specials, but they have not announced anything recently about that, so I don't know where that stands. But, you know, me personally, I like the one-hour format. I really don't want that to change. That's one of the reasons why Rampage is an easy watch, even if the show is kind of dull sometimes. You know, it's an easy watch. It's an hour. It's over. Boom. I go on. We talk about it. Now they're going to probably go to 2 hours and go off at midnight. At least this week, I don't mind because they have a loaded show. The show is not loaded up like this every week. But this is going to be a lot of fun to watch this week. And if you are going to Arthur Ashe, and I know some people, I have friends who are going, enjoy. I'm sure it's going to be a fun time. But come on over to YouTube as soon as the shows are over, because I'm going to be right here, live, talking about everything that goes down. You can join me on the YouTube channel and head on over there and subscribe and all that good stuff. Now let's switch over to Monday Night Raw, because there was a big story coming out of Raw this week. I like it when good things happen to good people. On Monday night, we got to see that when Big E cashed in his Money in the Bank contract on Bobby Lashley to win the WWE Championship. Everybody across the wrestling world, from all sorts of promotions, chimed in with congratulatory messages for Big E, and it made for a very memorable ending to this week's episode of Raw. Was it a panic move? You bet your ass it was. Of course it was. Now you can blame it on football. You can blame it on AEW Dynamite doing a better number last week than Raw did in the key demo, which, by the way, they did again this week. And I would almost guarantee you they will do it again this week. Now, and it may sound like an insignificant thing to some of you. What does one have to do with the other? They're on different nights. I've heard all these arguments. But I was puzzled at first last Friday when they started advertising. I was watching SmackDown, and they start advertising a WWE title match for Raw between Bobby Lashley and Randy Orton. Because I had just watched on Raw, I just watched them announce it for Extreme Rules. That was going to be the Raw main event at Extreme Rules. All of a sudden, late in the week, plans changed. And I thought, well, I guess somebody realized that Monday Night Football was back this week. But then I thought about it some more, and that doesn't really make any sense because they already knew that. They knew that weeks ago. They knew football was coming back. So why the sudden change? It just so happened to come after the ratings had come out on Thursday. After the Dynamite numbers dropped, it was the very next day that the news broke that, hey, we're getting a WWE title match on Raw. So that was no coincidence. You have to understand something. Even though these shows air on completely different nights, it's a status thing. With WWE, it's a status thing. They cannot have another wrestling promotion, another wrestling show doing better numbers, even if it is just one demo, which just so happens to be the demo that advertisers watch. They cannot accept it. It's why WWE has now rebooted and gone from NXT to NXT 2.0. Because if Triple H had done his job and kept AEW at bay on Wednesdays, I guarantee you there would be no 2.0. We would still be working off version 1.5. Whatever it was, plans changed. We sat through a tag team gauntlet match 2 weeks ago that took up half the show, which was rendered completely meaningless by canceling the tag team title match with Lashley and MVP against Orton and Riddle. That was going to be the main event on Raw this week. And I have not heard that they have added it to the show tomorrow night. Maybe they'll do it at some point still. Probably not, because it looks like MVP is actually going away to have surgery. So think about that. Half of the show 2 weeks ago was dedicated to a gauntlet match to determine number one contenders for the Raw tag team titles, and it was meaningless. Rendered totally meaningless. As I always say with these segments on that 3-hour show, it's all filler. Just to pass the time, we've got to put something out there. Let's just come up with something. It doesn't even matter if we follow up on it. We have to come up with something to kill time. That's what Raw has become. It's just a way to kill time. So they panicked. And panic booking can be a tricky thing. Sometimes it ends well. Other times it's a train wreck and you can't look away from it. In this case, they moved Big E off of SmackDown, a brand where really, let's be honest, I mean, there wasn't anywhere left for him to go. He wasn't beating Roman Reigns. So they sent him to a brand that was in dire need of a new top babyface. Randy Orton is part of a tag team. AJ Styles, also part of a tag team, although he's a heel anyway. He's not a babyface. Drew McIntyre has been moved down the card. Damian Priest, he is ascending nicely, but it's too soon to vault him into the top spot. He's got the United States title right now to defend. Keith Lee, he's busy wrestling dark matches until they figure out what the fuck to do with him. So they needed somebody fresh on that show. Big E having the briefcase was the logical choice. Now, it isn't the way that I would have done the cash-in. It's not the way I would have handled things. The time to really have done this, and I talked about it on the podcast at that time, the time to do this would have been at SummerSlam. After Lashley had already destroyed Xavier Woods, he had already destroyed Kofi Kingston, Big E should have come to Raw to avenge his friends and announce that he was going to be cashing in. Call his shot, just the way that RVD did back in 2006. Hey, John Cena, guess what? I'm cashing in on you. I'm going to cash in on you at the Hammerstein Ballroom at One Night Stand. He didn't jump him from behind. He didn't beat him up in the dressing room. He didn't wait until John Cena had another match and he was tired and hurt and bleeding, and then he came out and cashed in. He was a babyface who said, I'm letting you know in advance, this is when and where I'm going to cash in on you. And that's what Big E could have done for SummerSlam. And he could have had his big moment in front of 45,000 people. But clearly it was more important to get Goldberg and Sundberg on the show. So we didn't get them. It would have been nice to build up the anticipation a little bit more over more than just the period of 6 hours. Big E put a tweet out in the middle of the day announcing, hey, I'm cashing in tonight. It doesn't get any more straightforward than that. Hey guys, I want you to know I'm going to be on Raw tonight and I'm going to cash in and win the WWE Championship. And that was the heads up that we had. At least he called his shot. I like that. Big E should not have been ambushing Bobby Lashley. It would have felt hollow, even though that is kind of what he did anyway. He waited until after Lashley pinned Orton and sold a knee injury before he cashed in. But he did give advance warning that he was going to be doing that. Now, I defended the move on Twitter. I defended it. The fact that he was going to be cashing in on Raw. As soon as I saw Big E's tweet, I went on my Twitter. I said, you know what? Maybe it'll actually make the show more interesting. After I saw so many people crapping on that move earlier in the day, I said, Monday Night Raw is such an obnoxiously boring, uninspiring television show that if they want a hot shot, a Money in the Bank cash in and a title change, what's the problem? The show is fucking awful. If they want to spice it up for one night and try to put something exciting out there for a change, maybe it'll keep me from dozing off by hour three. Maybe we get a more entertaining show out of it. And you should have seen some of the replies that I got from angry WWE stans who don't know how to read, which is not surprising given the collective IQ of some of these people. I would expect them to have the reading comprehension of a doorknob. I said, I'm defending the move. What don't you understand? I'm defending the move, you dingbats. I'm at the point where anything they can try that might bring some excitement to the show, go for it. Have at it. Now, in this case, it didn't work because outside of Lashley and Orton and Big E, it was the same old shit. But it was worth trying. I thought the opening segment was effective at setting things up for later on in the night. It wasn't effective ratings-wise. Raw was way down this week, even promoting a Money in the Bank cash-in in advance. 1.6 million viewers, their lowest mark since July 12th. So football is already doing a number on them. I mean, between that and these AEW numbers, they're going to be digging up some bodies to trot out for the next Legends Night episode. We're going to be getting Andre the Giant and Macho Man Randy Savage on Raw soon, Weekend at Bernie style, if these numbers get any lower. So how did they have Randy Orton explain the change in date for his championship match? Well, he came out and he said he simply asked for it. And it was granted because he's Randy freaking Orton. There you go. No further explanation needed, I guess. Actually, I can believe that. I could actually believe that. Charlotte Flair beat Shayna Baszler off of a distraction from Nia Jax. Alexa Bliss came out after and gave Charlotte a present, which was her very own doll named Charlie. Looked just like Charlotte, which are already on sale right now at WWE Shop for $40 a pop. It's a little plush doll made to look like Charlotte with a robe and it's got a Raw women's title belt around her waist. I am convinced that if Alexa Bliss came out with a used toothpick with little bits of food on it that she had for lunch that she picked out of her teeth, and they sold replicas, authentic replicas on WWE Shop, they would sell out of that too. Last week, Jeff Hardy chased after the 24/7 title. This week, he competed for the United States Championship, and he lost. But at least it was an upgrade. At least he's aiming a little bit higher this week. Doudrop, she picked up another quick win over Eva Marie. I have no idea why Eva Marie is employed. I am truly at a loss. I do not know why this woman has a job in this company. Is it the Total Divas stuff? It's got to be maybe the Total Divas stuff, I guess. I mean, does she still draw eyeballs to this show because of that? Because it's not for her work in the ring. So I'm not sure why she is wrestling. I thought she was being brought in to be a manager. At least then she could have gotten some heat. But they have her in the fucking ring. It's embarrassing to watch her out there. I have no idea why she's here. Everything else on this show is just filler. I liked the match with Lashley and Orton. Orton hit the RKO near the end. Place erupted. MVP pulled Lashley to safety. So he ate an RKO on the floor. Lashley hit a spear. He pinned Orton. After the match, he gave Orton a dominator through the announce desk. And Lashley then started selling his knee. Like he couldn't put any weight on it. He started hobbling up the ring steps. And Big E's music suddenly started playing. I thought Lashley did an incredible job here, an incredible sell job. He had me convinced that something happened on the table spot and he popped his knee and he had a legitimate injury, which he didn't. Big E said that he was cashing in his money in the bank. He slapped Lashley across the face. Lashley, if you watched him, if you watched his lips moving, he told the referee to ring the fucking bell because that woke him up. He was pissed after that. And they immediately cut to a 2-minute break, which killed a lot of the excitement. I may have gotten the order wrong. Now, I don't remember if the slap came before or after the break, but the point is, you have this money in the bank cash and everybody's all excited. Let's go to commercial. So they went to a commercial. That was very dumb. Even if they had no, you know, they had no control over it, they should have formatted the show in such a way that you don't go to commercial during a money in the bank cash. But when they came back, they had a short match. It ended with Big E hitting the big ending and winning the title. Total ass-backwards psychology, having the injured heel trying to fend off the fresh and rested babyface. But out comes Kofi and out comes Woods, and they're celebrating. They shot off a bunch of pyro. This did not have the emotion that Kofi Kingston's win did at WrestleMania a couple of years ago, but, I mean, how could it? It was still a very cool moment. And what I want to do here is I want to take a minute to give praise to Bobby Lashley. Now that it is over, and I have no idea if he'll ever get it back, I thought he had a very good run as the WWE champion. Even if the numbers didn't reflect it, they didn't reflect for Drew McIntyre either. Although part of that was it being the whole Thunderdome era. But this is the Lashley that I have been waiting to see since he came back to the company in 2018. He reinvented himself during his time at Impact. I was still watching Impact Wrestling at that time. And I think it was, he was still there. I fell off again shortly thereafter. But when I got back into Impact for those few years, for at least part of that time, he was there. He was at like the tapings when they would come to the Manhattan Center. He was the champion at the time. The work that he put in as the Impact World Champion and the matches that he had there, the way, you know, he came out of his shell, personality-wise. I wanted to see him doing that in WWE. It took 3 years, but we finally got to see it. It started with the formation of the Hurt Business last year. The best part of those empty arena Raw shows was the Hurt Business. They put the U.S. title on him. They kept him strong. He was unbeaten. It seemed like they were doing that for a reason. I said, it looks like they're building him up for a WWE championship match at WrestleMania. Only we didn't get a championship match at WrestleMania. We got a championship match on Raw a few weeks before WrestleMania. And he beat The Miz. So this, by the way, this week, this makes 2 straight WWE title changes on Raw. We've had 3 WWE title changes on Raw in less than a year. After having gone 5 years without a single one. But we had the Hurt Business, and then they split up the Hurt Business going into WrestleMania for no reason other than to try to ensure that Drew McIntyre would be cheered at WrestleMania. That is what I believe. The Hurt Business had a cool factor, and I believe that they wanted to ensure that there was no chance that Drew McIntyre was going to go out there in front of these fickle fans and be booed. I truly believe they were worried that Bobby Lashley, as, you know, the leader of the Hurt Business, was going to go out there and get a bigger babyface pop, potentially, than Drew McIntyre did. And I think, if I remember, I think Lashley got a pretty good reaction, although McIntyre was, you know, he got a nice babyface reaction, you know, no issues there. But I do believe that they were worried about that, because you try to come up with another explanation for why they had to break that group up when they did. Maybe by now they would have been broken up. But when they did it, it was way premature. And there were stories about Lashley and MVP going to Vince and meeting with Vince and pleading with him, trying to state their case, don't do this. Like, this is not the time to do it. And Vince was adamant about it. Now, why would he be so adamant about it if he wasn't worried about getting the reaction that he wanted to at WrestleMania? Why did they have to do it when they did? Ask yourself that question. There was no good reason for them to do that. But they had a good thing going. Now that Lashley has lost the title, I would like to see them reform the Hurt Business, even if they swap out one member for another, whether that's Shelton, whether it's Cedric, or just keep the crew together. I would like to see them reform the Hurt Business. And I don't think it should be Keith Lee, because Keith Lee, if he's going to be a heel, I don't think he needs to be part of a group with Bobby Lashley. I think Keith Lee would do fine on his own. But whatever the Hurt Business looks like, I would like to see them reformed. You know, Lashley feels like he needs his boys back to help watch his back. The only thing that, you know, could put a little bit of a crimp in those plans is the fact that MVP is probably going to be gone for a while. WWE claimed that he suffered a broken rib, which I'm assuming is a storyline injury, but they claim a broken rib on the RKO from Randy Orton. And when MVP saw that tweet, he quote tweeted it. And he said, well, since I'm out with my broken rib, maybe I should get my knee fixed. So I don't know when we're going to be seeing him again. Hopefully not too long, because that's one of the first things I would do when they shake up the rosters in a few weeks, is put that group back together. They made it official this week. The draft is coming. It starts on the October 1st SmackDown in Baltimore. Continues the following Monday on Raw from Nashville. They already have local advertising in Baltimore for Roman Reigns one-on-one against Drew McIntyre. In the future, they should either do away with the Raw versus SmackDown stuff at Survivor Series or move the damn draft earlier in the year. Say this every single year. I don't know why they insist on doing it in the fall. Unless it just has to do with fall. You know, the television networks, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. The time to do the draft is either after Survivor Series, because if you're going to do Raw versus SmackDown, right, you build to the big pay-per-view, and then when that pay-per-view is over, you do a draft a few weeks later. Or you wait until after WrestleMania. WrestleMania is sort of a reset for a lot of storylines. 2 weeks later, you do a draft on TV. Doing it this way, you know, it would mean a lot more than just having people change brands and a month later act like it matters what the fucking color of their shirt is, because it doesn't. As I look ahead to future opponents for Big E, I have to assume there's going to be a rematch with Lashley at Extreme Rules. Has not been announced yet, but I don't think he's losing it back to Lashley that quickly. I think that would be squandering a lot of goodwill with people who were very happy to see Big E win that championship. Can you imagine the backlash after the week that he's had and all the messages and all the interviews and the PR that he's been doing if a week or two later Big E loses the championship right back to Lashley? I don't think that's going to go over very well. I don't see that happening. I look at the Raw roster and it really doesn't even matter, because Raw is probably going to look very different in 3 weeks than it does right now. And I don't know what the future holds for, you know, Kevin Owens, given his contract status. But I look at a guy like KO and boy, you know, if anybody is due for a fresh start and a vicious heel turn, it's Kevin Owens. Did you see him on SmackDown this week? He comes across like just another guy on the show. Like he doesn't even look happy to be there. How could he be? So that's one move I would make in the draft. We'll see how things shake out in the draft. But congrats to Big E. I was getting him ready to be my Royal Rumble winner at the beginning of this year. So I think he's more than ready. I'm one of those people. I'm in the camp of, you know, oh, he's not ready. No, he was more than ready. He was more than ready to stake his claim and get a run with the championship. I just hate that it had to come at the expense of Bobby Lashley, because I thought he was doing a great job. WWE made it official this week. Roman Reigns will defend his Universal Championship against Brock Lesnar October 21st at Sweet Saudi Money 6. Enough of this. Provided, of course, Roman can first get past the Demon Balor at Extreme Rules. 7 days. We are 7 days away from Extreme Rules next Sunday with 6 matches announced, and not one of those matches has any sort of extreme stipulation. We have Roman Reigns against Finn Balor as the Demon for the Universal title, Becky Lynch against Bianca Belair for the SmackDown Women's title, Charlotte Flair against Alexa Bliss for the Raw Women's title, the Usos against the Street Profits for the SmackDown Tag Team titles, Damian Priest against Sheamus and possibly Jeff Hardy if he wins his match against Sheamus on Raw tomorrow night. That'll be for the United States Championship. And Liv Morgan, one-on-one against Carmella. Why even keep this dumb pay-per-view? They throw a ladder match on there and they call it extreme. It's not extreme. Just get rid of it already. Just call it something else. I don't know why they insist on keeping this Extreme Rules shit around. What was it last year? Remember they gave a subtitle last year? That was the pay-per-view that I believe they did the eyeball angle, right? With Rey Mysterio that we had so much fun with on the live stream when the show was over. The Horror Show, that's what it was, last July. It was the Horror Show at Extreme Rules. At least we're not getting a horror show this year. But I thought SmackDown on Friday was a painfully average show. I was still coming down from the high of that Madison Square Garden show. I know they can't all be like that, but this was just a very average, very dull show. They had Big E on there, fresh off his WWE title win, to tease a match with Roman Reigns. He actually teamed up with Finn Balor against the Usos in what they called a championship contenders match. Having the Raw champion show up to take part in a championship contenders match for the SmackDown tag team titles is stupid. And they won. Big E and Balor won. They beat the Usos. The match itself was good, but the reason that Big E was on this show in the first place was to set up what followed, which was a backstage assault by the Usos who left him laying. You know, they're setting up for brand warfare at Survivor Series, as they do every year. And I thought, the match to do this year is not Roman Reigns one-on-one against Big E. It's the Bloodline against the New Day. And I had that in my notes, and I was going to talk about that and pitch that here on the show. And then they stole my thunder. They stole my thunder on Friday by doing that angle, and then they just came out and they announced the match. They could have headlined with it as a Survivor Series. My idea was you do it at Survivor Series, and you could even make it a Survivor Series elimination match. And I think that easily could have headlined the show. Not only that, I think that that could have been great on the level of what we got with The Shield and the Wyatt family, which I'm a huge fan of. This could have been like that. And maybe it still has that potential to be that good. But clearly these ratings have spooked them recently, and so we're getting the match tomorrow night. They're not even waiting for the draft shows. Like, if they couldn't wait for Survivor Series, it's like, all right, well, the draft is coming up. Well, maybe they can make a big TV main event out of it for one of the draft shows. They're not even waiting for that. They're doing it the week before. Tomorrow night, the Bloodline is coming to Raw. Roman Reigns is coming to Monday Night Raw. You know what? It's like I said earlier with the Big E stuff and the Money in the Bank cashing. Anything that they can do to make that show more palatable is fine with me. If that's what they want to do, fuck. You know what? Their company, fine. Do it. Do it. I still think it should have been the main event of Survivor Series. I think they're fucking dumb for not holding it for that. But if they want to give us that match on TV tomorrow night, I'll be there watching. I'm looking forward to the match. It should be very good. Seth Rollins cut a promo on Edge, who he beat last week and who is still at home recuperating. But he just can't let it go, and he has to fight him one more time, he says. You knew this was coming. You knew this was going to go to a rubber match because they were one win apiece, but I still think it's silly that Rollins is the one issuing the challenge given that he just beat the guy and he sent him away on a stretcher. It should be Edge who comes back for revenge for Rollins trying to end his career. They gave us the match that was cut from the MSG show last week with Carmella and Zelina Vega against Liv Morgan and Toni Storm, who now has a new nickname. Everybody on the main roster gets a nickname, as we know. Michael Cole called her the Wild Child of the 80s. And he explained that her mom got her into that kind of music as a kid. So did mine. Why the hell do you think I love Hall & Oates so much? But that's what she is now. She is the Wild Child of the 80s. Doesn't matter, though, because Toni Storm was a fucking afterthought on this show. Carmella went into the turnbuckle face first, literally 2 minutes into the match. And she grabs her nose and she starts screaming, "Ah, my nose, my nose." And Zelina's checking on her and the two of them just walk out. They get counted out of the ring and they walk to the back, 2 minutes into the match. So now Carmella and Liv Morgan, who have had issues for a while, they're going to have a match at Extreme Rules. And I said before, none of these matches have any extreme stipulations to them. Well, I predict the match will be extremely short. That's my prediction for the match between Carmella and Liv Morgan. Like a lot of these women's matches we've been seeing on TV recently, unless your name is Charlotte Flair, then you'll get about 10 or 12 minutes. Otherwise, you're lucky if you get three. Naomi. Here's something I liked. Naomi finally had enough of Sonya Deville's bullshit. And she confronted her backstage. She told her, she was in the middle of a conversation, she told her to get off the phone and said, "I've been very patient and very respectful of you up to this point, and now I want to know, when is my next match?" And Sonya told her, "Check back with me next week." And Naomi said, "I'm going to get that match, one way or another." She cut a promo on her. I thought Naomi was fantastic in this segment. We need to see more of that, Naomi. Less of this glow shit and more of this. We were later on told that Naomi was fined for insubordination, and Sonya had this to say on Talking Smack. "I have to address the elephant in the room because it's really getting under my skin. The way Naomi talked to me tonight, the way she treated me, is absolutely unacceptable behavior for everybody in the locker room across the board, male, female, SmackDown, Raw, or NXT for that matter. Nobody is to talk to a WWE official in that manner. She is lucky that she got a fine. I don't know what she thinks stepping to me and getting aggressive in my face is going to do. I am a WWE official and I'm not going to lay my hands on a WWE talent. Let's just make that crystal clear." She may not lay her hands on her as a WWE official, but if she either quit or was relieved of her duties as a WWE official, then I suppose she wouldn't have that problem now, would she? So there's your loophole. The match is coming. I don't know when, but the match is coming. Maybe on draft night. The final segment of the show was a homecoming in Knoxville. They were in Knoxville, Tennessee, for Bianca Belair. I thought this segment fell flat. She got a great reaction. She came out in her hometown, and everybody loved her, and her family was in the front row. Mayor Kane made a surprise appearance. I didn't even put two and two together and think that he would be there, but he came out as a surprise. The mayor of Knox County. There he was in his suit and his tie, Libertarian Kane, here on this show. Back again. He presented her with the key to the city. Becky Lynch interrupted. And she talked some smack. She did offer to shake hands. And Bianca accepted, but she wouldn't let go. And she hoisted up Becky for the KOD. Becky slipped out. And she hit the manhandle slam. You thought she was actually going to hit the KOD? What do you think this is? You think this is AEW? This is Vince McMahon. When you're in someone's hometown, you got to get heat. Everything's got to be heat. So, of course, Becky got the last laugh here in Bianca's hometown. And that is how they went off the air. I got to say this. If SmackDown loses Roman Reigns, and they're not going to, but if they lost Roman Reigns in this draft, this show is in a lot of trouble. That's all I'm going to say. We'll see if the SmackDown A-Show thing is still true when this draft is over. I'm a little concerned, frankly, that they're going to gut SmackDown. USA Network has been in WWE's ear. They've been unhappy about this, that, and the other. And they're going to want to even things out a little bit more. I don't know what SmackDown is going to look like when this draft is over. But at least if they keep Roman Reigns and Heyman and the Bloodline stuff and all of that, that pretty much is what's carrying the show at this point. I think SmackDown will be okay. Some other news and notes before we get into this new NXT, like New Coke. They better hope this version lasts a lot longer than New Coke did. Andrew Yang is back. He didn't have a lot of luck running for mayor here in New York City. That's putting it lightly. It was an embarrassing failure. Now he has a new book coming out and supposedly is going to be announcing plans very shortly around the time the book comes out to start a new third political party here in this country. But all of a sudden he is back talking about pro wrestling being misclassified and all the wrestlers being classified as independent contractors when they should be classified as employees. He's back on this again. On Thursday, he tweeted this. Had a call with the Department of Labor. If you are a current or former WWE performer who feels you were misclassified as an independent contractor, contact at, and then he gives the person's handle, and let's get you what Vince owes you. Been a long time coming, but this storyline is real. And the lawyer that he tagged is Lucas Middlebrook. He is a labor attorney who has gone after UFC before and failed. He's advocated the need for fighters to unionize. He will not have any more success here than he did there. That is my prediction. What's frustrating about this is that it is a totally valid issue that Yang is talking about. He's not wrong when he says that wrestlers in WWE are misclassified as independent contractors. Just think about how much more control WWE has over these people. And the fact, and this is the one thing at least that does separate WWE from AEW and Impact and other promotions, who, by the way, this is going to affect them too. If anything were to ever happen, this doesn't just affect WWE. This affects AEW and everybody else. But one of the biggest differences between those promotions and WWE is the fact that you're not allowed to work outside dates. You are not allowed to go book yourself on this independent show or go book yourself on this TV show. You're not allowed to do that. The way you are treated like an employee in many ways. When you look at the criteria for it, it checks all the boxes, or at least enough of them, to be classified as an employee. So it is a legitimate issue. But Andrew Yang is not the person who's going to change anything. He talked a big talk on Twitter before Biden won, and then absolutely nothing happened. That was almost a full year ago. After Zelina Vega got fired and she posted that tweet in support of unionization, I support unionization, and then she later deleted it when she went back to WWE. And boy, do you think that she regrets going back there now? I almost feel sorry for her. She made the choice to go back, so I don't, but I almost do. But Yang wouldn't shut up about it. Vince McMahon, this is a year ago. He goes, Vince McMahon, I haven't forgotten about you. It's like Braun Strowman. I'm not finished with you. Call him Braun Yang. Or Andrew Strowman. He was going on and on and on a year ago in November last year on social media about all this stuff. Like he was cutting a promo on Vince McMahon. He doesn't say who at the Department of Labor or what position the person is that he spoke with. I imagine the conversation went a little something like this. Hi, this is Andrew Yang. I'd like to speak with Marty Walsh. Marty Walsh is the Secretary of Labor. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Yang. Mr. Walsh is in a meeting right now. Oh, okay, well, we'll tell him Andrew called. Will do, sir. That was his call with the Department of Labor. But he followed that up with a couple of more tweets. A few hours later, he says, in one tweet, he goes, all you have to do is believe. And then the next tweet was, early returns are positive. Chalk this one up in the I'll believe it when I see it category. I think his intentions are good. I don't think he's a bad person. He's talked about being a wrestling fan before. I think his intentions are good. But people get their hopes up about this stuff. Nothing is going to come out of this. It never does. You know who almost did, though? You know who almost changed the entire wrestling business? Daphne. But she couldn't get anybody to stand with her. And that has always been the problem. You need some big names to stand up and attach their names to efforts like this. And they never do, and they never will. When John Cena showed up at SummerSlam for his match against Roman Reigns, he was wearing a new t-shirt that paid homage to one of the greatest games ever made, Super Mario Bros. 3. You couldn't buy the shirt individually, though. It was only available as part of a limited edition NFT kit that WWE was selling for $1,000. He was asked about that during a Q&A session during Florida SuperCon last Sunday in Miami Beach. The fan wanted to know, $1,000? Why? How? And credit to Jim Varsalone for the video that I watched of Cena's response, him answering the question. According to Cena, their attempt to sell the kit at that price was, in his words, a catastrophic failure. He said WWE wanted to put together a once-in-a-lifetime fan experience. This kit is not just this shirt, because he was wearing the shirt during the Q&A. He goes, it's not just this shirt, it's the belt, it's the hat, it's the shirt, it's two sets of wristbands, a towel, an autograph picture, an autograph canvas picture, and an NFT. When we came up with the face value for what all of that would cost, it came out to about $500 or $600 total. And then we threw in the value of the NXT, which is a very low value right now. The value of the NFT, he said. So I talk a lot about failure. This idea failed. Why is it $1,000? Because myself and the folks at WWE thought that $1,000 was a fair price point. We were wrong. We were absolutely wrong. This shirt is number 000 of 500 that I'm wearing. I thought with a value like that, the 500 of them will be gone. And he said, we sold 37 of them. It was a catastrophic failure. And I designed all of my stuff. I was super proud of this. I love the design. It's one of those instances where I put my heart and soul into it. I did the design, and I was really close with the work and the pieces and the market research. Yes, this seems fair. I think it'll be good. And it sucked. It absolutely failed. I took a chance and it missed. I'm sorry because it's obvious that people like the design, but it's way too much. And good on him for being honest. I still don't get the whole NFT thing. Or evidently any of this crypto stuff. I'm still bitter I lost money on that stupid MJF coin that I got talked into doing. Last time I ever get involved with any of that crypto crap. But good on John Cena for being on it. I like the shirt. I hope they sell it. I don't know that I'll buy it, but it would be nice if they put that shirt on sale separately. I didn't see it on WWE Shop, but they should sell it at some point as a standalone item. And sad tweet this week goes to Paige, at Real Paige WWE, who tweeted, I'ma have to speak to the manager of this magazine. And she included a screen grab from an article that I had to go seek out myself. I had to go find this article. I didn't know where it was from. I had to type the quote into Google hoping it would come up, and it did. But I had to seek this out just to confirm that it was real. And it is. It is indeed real. And it is from an article by Axel Rosenberg, the co-founder and co-editor-in-chief of the website MetalSucks.net. His name sounds about as real as his other editor-in-chief that I see listed on the site, Vince Neilstein. Anyway, Axel wrote a story about Ronnie Radke, who Paige has been dating for the past 3 years, He is the frontman for a band called Falling in Reverse, which was formed while he was serving time in prison. And apparently he flipped out during a show after spotting some dude wearing a Fuck Ronnie Radke shirt in the audience. And they transcribed his rant. I will only read part of it to you. "Where's the guy with the Fuck Ronnie Radke shirt? I noticed that he saw me and then he pulled it down. You do not want the fucking smoke, homie. I will beat your fucking ass. This is not Twitter. I'll beat your fucking ass. How old are you? Bro, you're like fucking 40, in the front row with a self-made Fuck Ronnie Radke shirt. You are not married. You are not married." And it just goes on from there. And he said his 8-year-old daughter was there with him, and he told the guy to show some respect. But that's not even what wins the award. The part of the story that Paige tweeted was this line that somebody actually wrote after Radke chastised this person in the audience for not being married. The author wrote this: "Radke is himself not married. He has been dating former WWE star Diamond Dallas Page since 2018. I fucking, when I first read that, I fucking cried. What a way for Paige to find out that her boyfriend has been cheating on her. With another wrestler, no less. I mean, Dallas does keep himself very flexible with all that DDP yoga. Oh, I fucking cried when I read that. It may not have been her mistake, but she tweeted it. So I'm giving her the honors this week, Paige. Not DDP, the other one. Paige, your winner for Sad Tweet of the Week. MetalSucks.net, the slice wrestling of the heavy metal world. Remind me to never get my news from them. So this week was the big NXT 2.0 reboot. And Nick Khan was not kidding when he said that they were rebooting this. Gone is the dark look with lots of skulls and metal music and Poppy, probably no more Poppy. Poor Triple H. He must be devastated. Yeah, he was not present at the show. Shawn Michaels was said to be calling the plays backstage. The only update on Triple H per the Observer is that he is at home. He is taking phone calls, but he is not doing a whole lot else. Talent has been told they could call him if they want to wish him well after his heart procedure, but they are not to talk any WWE business with him. I can imagine everything going on is very stressful for him. I can see why they would not want that to upset him. But now the show is all bright and colorful, and, you know, what they basically have done here is they have knocked it back about 10 years. To the FCW days. This is very much now a developmental show. What this is NXT Dark Elevation. That's what the show is now. And that isn't totally a bad thing, because one of the casualties of the pandemic were the NXT live event loops that they would usually do around the Florida area. They haven't run any shows at all in a year and a half. Those were the shows where a lot of these unknown names and these green guys and girls, they would be able to go out and work in front of an actual crowd, even if that crowd was only 150 people. They would be able to go out there in front of people, and they would work, and they would learn, and they would improve, hopefully. Since the pandemic started, all they've been doing is signing these people and collecting them like trophies and sticking them in the performance center to train. You can only train so much without working actual matches in front of live crowds. But as a consequence of this, it looks like we're going to end up with a lot of really inexperienced people working matches on television. So gone are the days where they would be building to a big takeover show based around great in-ring matches with indie workers that they signed, to something now more akin to what NXT was originally intended to be. I don't know that that's what USA Network believed that they were getting when they paid for the show, but that's their problem. USA Network is responsible for three-hour Raws. Fuck USA Network. But they're taking the show back to its roots. If we, of course, ignore the game show phase of NXT, we'll just pretend that didn't happen. Back when it used to air on Sci-Fi. I'm going to keep an open mind about this. This was only the first episode. It's week one. It was all over the place. There was some good, there was some bad. But first, Samoa Joe surrendered his NXT championship in a shocking announcement last Sunday. These things always seem to happen right after the podcast drops. It was later that night, after the podcast had already dropped, that Samoa Joe put a video out on his social media. He looked like he was sitting in his room at his house, announcing that WWE Medical had sidelined him. And he did not explain why. He didn't give any kind of details. And that all he said is he is no longer the NXT champion. Now, it may well be a legitimate medical issue, but color me skeptical, given the timing of the announcement, coming 48 hours before the big relaunch, with a number one contenders match that was conveniently turned into a title match. Joe has not wrestled a match since his takeover win over Karrion Kross. So unless he was hurt in that match and they decided to strip him because he's still not cleared, which is always possible, yes, I do believe there is good reason to want. It does not make you a bad person if you're wondering, the timing is a little suspicious. It worked to their advantage, being able to promote that a new champion would be crowned. And look, if it is an injury or if it's an illness, this man just has the worst luck. I mean, if he didn't have bad luck, he wouldn't have any luck at all. So here's hoping he gets back quickly. Even though Samoa Joe would not seem to really fit what they're looking for in this new NXT, I don't look at Samoa Joe and think he's bright and colorful. I don't see that. I think we may have seen the last of Samoa Joe as the NXT champion. I don't believe Samoa Joe is going to become the first ever four-time NXT champion. Johnny Gargano, he was also in the news in a Fightful Select report about his NXT contract coming due. It is expiring on December 3rd. WWE sources told Fightful that the two sides have not yet entered into negotiations on a new deal, but they are expected to sometime in the fall. Well, I would think so, given that his contract is up in the fall. When else are they going to engage into conversations and negotiations? Gee, golly, yeah, well, in the fall they're going to talk. Well, I sure hope so. Boy, you know, looking at that calendar, I assume it's going to be the fall. Gargano has been with NXT now for 6 years. He has been the NXT champion. He has been the North American champion. He has been an NXT tag team champion. But I cannot imagine him leaving, even though he has done all of these different things over such a long period of time on this show. I cannot imagine him leaving. Plus, his wife works there. I don't think her deal is up until later next year, supposedly. I think when the dust settles on this one, Johnny Wrestling is going to be staying put right where he is. And I think he should. I think it's the right place for him to be. So, it's definitely a lot brighter with all the rainbow colors. It looks like a Lucky Charms factory explosion in that place. But I think the improved lighting looks good. I like the little, the little arena they made for themselves there. They finally did away with all the plexiglass barriers, which was a huge plus. And I like that they can fit more people in there now. I still don't think it's as many as they had in Full Sail. That they can get 400 or 500 people in there. I don't think they can fit that many, but it's more than what they had before. Apparently there is an edict that it is no longer to be referred to as the Capitol Wrestling Center. It is no longer the CWC. The COVID Coliseum, I guess, is no more. It is now simply the home of NXT. Boy, that word wrestling must really be allergic to that word wrestling, even though it's in the name of the company. They don't like that word. We had quite a few second-generation names getting their moment of glory on this show, starting with Bron Breakker. Braun is short for Bronson, which is his real name, the son of Rick Steiner, who had just been given the name Rex Steiner, R-E-X, which was actually a really cool name. And then he is given a shitty name so they could trademark it. He even had Steiner written on his boots. So I guarantee you this is something they threw at him a few hours before the show started, the day of. Bad name aside, they obviously see a huge upside with him because from the moment that the show started, he interrupted an LA Knight promo in the back and he got a match with him. And then he beat him. He pinned LA Knight, the same LA Knight who was the one, he was one of the four men challenging in the main event for the NXT Championship on this very show. So there's a lot to unwrap here. They made no mention of the fact that he is the son of Rick Steiner. Vic Joseph at one point made a dog face gremlin reference that was about as close as they came to making any kind of Steiner reference. But he sounds exactly like a cross between his dad and his uncle. I mean, it is eerie. I would say leaning more towards Scott. If you close your eyes and you just listen to him speak, you would swear it was Scott Steiner. But then at the end of the show, he confronted the new NXT champion in the back, and that's how they went off the air. So they started with Breaker and they ended with Breaker. We didn't really see enough of him in the ring, I think, to fully judge, but he looked good for the time he was in there. He's already got the pedigree. They clearly, I don't mean the move. They clearly have high hopes for this guy. I'll say guy. I don't even know how old he is. I say kid. They clearly have high hopes for him. And he's going to be in line for a big push. And if you want to make a new star on their first night, you know what? A win over one of the contenders for the championship is one way to do it. It sort of reminded me of what they did with him, of John Cena's first night on SmackDown, how he confronted Kurt Angle about ruthless aggression. Right? Here he confronted LA Knight in the back. John Cena lost in his match, but Breaker won his. But like with Cena, when it was over in the back, he had a bunch of people coming up to him, offering him congratulations, shaking his hand, giving him hugs. Whether he can have himself the kind of career that John Cena had is a very different story, but they need to create new stars. They have to create new stars. The question is, how different is this NXT going to be as compared to, what we have traditionally had? Are they going to treat these guys like their own little pet projects and treat them better when they eventually move up to Raw or SmackDown? Or are they going to be victims of the same inept booking that has befallen a lot of other names that we have seen called up in years past from NXT? That is the million-dollar question. Maybe they could bring Ted DiBiase back and give us the answer. But that is the million-dollar question, for which we have no answer. I think I know what that answer is going to be, but we don't know yet. If Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard are going to be more hands-off with this version of NXT, or not hands-off, I'm sorry, hands-on, does that bode well for someone like Bron Breakker because they see him as one of their little pet projects? If they're more hands-on and this guy's getting a big push, does that mean good things for him in the future? Does that bode well for his future? If he's their project, he's Vince and Bruce's project, more so than Paul Levesque. That is the question. Brooks Jensen, he was another second generation name featured on this show. He was tagging with Josh Briggs in a losing effort against Marcel Bartel and Fabian Aichner of Imperium. Jensen and Briggs are going to be a tag team, it looks like, going forward. They've now put the two of them together. Jensen is the son of former WWE star Bull Buchanan. Remember Bull being on TV with Big Boss Man? I used to chant Bullshit Buchanan when he would come out. But he is the son of Bull Buchanan. He was only first signed a month ago, and already he's on TV. Again, NXT Dark Elevation. That is what this show is now, with a few bigger names mixed in. And then we had Von Wagner. Holy shit. And I thought Bron Breakker was the worst name on this show. He looks more like Van Hammer than Von Wagner. This fucking guy. Right down to the name. look like something out of a create a wrestler mode from one of the 2K games. He is Cal Bloom, the son of Wayne Bloom, who at one point was one of the Beverly Brothers in WWE. He actually wrestled the match on SmackDown last year as Cal Bloom, as himself, against Sheamus. This was during the early days of the Empty Arena pandemic shows. And there was a report at that time in April of 2020. I want to give them credit for this because they reported at that time. This was Paul Davis of WrestlingNews.co who said that he had heard from people in WWE that had seen Bloom's training at the PC who said that he could be a main event star for them within a few years. The source said, everybody is comparing him to a young Edge. Okay, so that was April of last year. Some pretty high praise there. Fast forward to this show, and Kyle O'Reilly is attacked in the back by Pete Dunne and Ridge Holland. That took him out of the Fatal 4-Way to crown a new NXT champion. So in his place, William Regal puts Von Wagner in the Fatal 4-Way, even though he has never wrestled a single match on NXT before. Because apparently he was, I guess, in the back, singing or directing his own orchestra with a fucking name like that. We have never seen Von Wagner before. At least not under that name. On NXT television. Never wrestled a single match on NXT before. He was the person, though, to show up and run off Pete Dunne and Ridge Holland. And so, therefore, he now finds himself in a championship match. There is no way to justify this. William Regal looked like a fucking idiot with this decision. And I don't care what kind of potential they think the kid has. He has no business being part of an NXT championship match. Carmelo Hayes had to go win a tournament for the right to challenge for the championship of his choosing. Von Wagner heard a commotion in the other room and went to go see what was going on, and he's gifted an opportunity to become the NXT champion. We got to see B-Fab make her in-ring debut against Katrina Cortez, who once upon a time was called up to Monday Night Raw to team with Sin Cara against Andrade and Zelina Vega, and then was promptly demoted right back to the PC. B-Fab looked a little rough in there. It also did not go more than 90 seconds, but what little we got was not good. Character-wise, though, I love her. I think she's great. I love the whole, still loving the whole Hit Row thing. Thankfully, they haven't abandoned the Hit Row Legado del Fantasma program. They're keeping that going. Electra Lopez walked out with Legado after the match, and they teased a match between B-Fab and Electra. But she was held back by Santos Escobar, so we'll have to wait for that match, I guess, for another day. Carmelo Hayes is a heel now, and he's got a new friend with him named Trick. Trick Williams. You know, with some of the goofy-ass names they give these people, and it's almost October, I'm surprised that his middle name wasn't Orr and his last name wasn't Treat. But Trick Williams is his name. He brought him in to help watch his back, since Hayes said, ever since I won this contract for a title match, I've got a target on me. And Trick told him that he was being too humble, he has to have a harder edge to him, and then he started cutting a promo like he was Enzo Amore. Only not nearly as good as Enzo was. They were leaving. Duke Hudson was on his way to the ring for a match. He blew right past them. Trick Williams, this offended him greatly. He says, see? He goes, no more of this. He's like Phil Leotardo from The Sopranos. No more, Butchie. No more. And he goes into the ring and he attacks Hudson. This didn't look great. Hayes then joined into the beatdown. It looked a little bit better at that point. But I guess that completed what is supposed to be a heel turn. Hudson was already a heel. So I'm not sure if this was a heel turn or they're just trying to give him a little bit more of an attitude. It felt like a heel turn to me. Carmelo Hayes is somebody who does come from the indies, and I picked him to win the breakout tournament. So when he won, I was very happy. I think the potential for him is sky high. And I would like to see him be one of the new featured faces of this new NXT relaunch. So I think giving him more of an attitude instead of having him act all humble, oh, I'm just happy to be here, giving him an attitude and a harder edge and say, yeah, you know what? Not only am I happy to be here, I'm better than all these other people. I'm the best thing you guys got. That's good. I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more of that attitude. Then we had a WWE main roster specialty, which is not good. We had a women's tag team match with Caden Carter and Casey Catanzaro against Gigi Dolin and JC Jane that ended quickly by DQ when Mandy Rose ran in. Then Saray ran in to aid the baby faces. And when they came back from break, we were in the middle of a trios match. The same tired formula we see on Raw and on SmackDown has now infected NXT. You can tell who is overseeing the show this week just based on the booking, or at least who the show is being written for. Mandy has gone from blonde to brunette. When she ran in, she was wearing a hood over her head, like she was bald, or hideously disfigured. And then she comes out and she pulls the hood off, and the big reveal is that she gave herself a dye job. The hood was a bit much, but it looks good on her. She wears it well. Mandy got the win for her team, which now has a name. They are calling themselves Toxic Attraction. I almost said Toxic Avengers. They should call themselves that. The way she was wearing that hood, I thought she was going to unmask and look like the Toxic Avenger. Toxic Attraction is their name. But now that I've said it out loud, I actually prefer Toxic Avengers. So it looks like they're going to be NXT's answer to the beautiful people. Toxic Attraction. It's what an odd choice, though, for a word to describe yourself. Toxic. I do have to say, I really like their music. Ever since Gigi Dolin got new music and started making regular appearances on NXT, and now I assume it's going to be the music for the whole group, it's a good tune. I like it. Somebody will have to let me know when the WWE Music YouTube channel puts it up. We had a vignette straight out of WWF in 1995 for a newcomer coming soon to NXT named Tony D'Angelo, who spoke with a thick Italian accent and was walking down the street talking about how his family's in the waste management business and various other industries. Gee, I wonder where they got that from. Where's the gabagool? Who ate all the gabagool? So his family, I guess the story is that his family, they didn't use this word, but his family is all mobbed up. That's what they implied. He used to be an amateur wrestler who realized that there's no money in amateur wrestling, which is undoubtedly true. The real money, he said, is in NXT. And he said this with a straight face. Once he said that, he lost all credibility in my book. The only thing this established is that he is not very bright if he thinks that the real money is in NXT. Please say, like, the real money is in WWE, and I'm going to start here in NXT, cracking heads. Then I would have been okay with it. The minute he said the real money is in NXT, I almost laughed about as hard as I did at Diamond Dallas Page dating Ronnie Radke. I think that Mr. D'Angelo over here would do better off staying in the family business and collecting all of that protection money from the local vendors, if that's the case. We had the Creed brothers. I'm a fan of these two. I said that a few weeks ago. I'm a fan of these two guys. They won another tag team squash. They have breathed new life into Diamond Mine, and Malcolm Bivens introduced us to the newest addition to Diamond Mine. Their first female addition, Ivy Nile, the star of NBC's Titan Games, we were told. I'll take their word for it because I don't watch NBC's Titan Games. In fact, I can't think of anything I watch on NBC. I started watching Young Rock, and then I just got pulled into other things, and I never went back to watch it. But I heard it's a really good show. I'll have to catch up with it at some point. I've only seen the first episode. Actually, that's not true. I watch Law & Order SVU and Organized Crime. What am I talking about? So that's what I watch on NBC. And I watch Shark Tank on ABC, and I think that's about it as far as non-wrestling shows on the major broadcast channels are concerned. But anyway, Kushida made his return, and Bivens challenged, he just walked out with the Cruiserweight Championship, and Bivens challenged him to put the title on the line this Tuesday against Roderick Strong. That has to be a title change. Gotta be. They're starting to really heat up Diamond Mine now. It would be foolish to have Strong lose to Kushida. So the Fatal 4-Way was up next. Tommaso Ciampa, Pete Dunne, LA Knight, and Kyle O'Reilly. That was originally going to be the lineup in this number one contenders match. And it ended up turning into a Fatal 4-Way with Tommaso Ciampa, Pete Dunne, LA Knight, who already lost at the beginning of the show, and Von Wagner to crown a brand new NXT champion. This went less than 10 minutes. I thought it was okay. It was good as a television main event, nothing more, with a surprise finish. I thought for sure that it was going to be LA Knight or Pete Dunne going over here. Pete Dunne was the favorite after the news broke that he signed a new deal to stay in WWE. Maybe it was the plan before Joe vacated the belt and it became a championship match. Maybe if it was still a number one contenders match, Pete Dunne would have gotten the win. But Goldie is home again. After more than 900 days, Tommaso Ciampa is once again the NXT champion. He has been phased down for so long, doing the tag team thing with Timothy Thatcher, and now he is the champion. The idea that they would have put the belt on Von Wagner is laughable, even if they do see him as a future main eventer. It's like Chris Jericho becoming the first AEW champion over Hangman Page. Chris Jericho was the right choice at the right time. Hangman Page was not ready for that spot. Now he is, but at the time he wasn't. 2 years from now, maybe Von Wagner, preferably with a better name, will be in a position to challenge and win the NXT Championship, but today is not that day. You put the title on the established veteran, and then you could always have him drop it to one of the young guys, if that's what they choose to do. LA Knight took the losing fall to Ciampa, meaning he got pinned twice on one show. I take that to mean that he's on his way to Raw or SmackDown in the draft. Even though NXT may not officially be part of the draft, he has to wind up on one of those two shows. That is where he needs to be. He does not need to be toiling away on the developmental show doing jobs for all of these people. I think he's entertaining. I think his ring work is fine. But personality-wise, promo-wise, he's a Raw guy or a SmackDown guy. There's no reason anymore for him to be on NXT. I enjoyed the storyline with the $1 million title and Cameron Grimes and Ted DiBiase. And in the end, the babyface, they got the win. It all paid off in the end. He's clearly not going to be the NXT champion. Get him off this show. Move him up to something else. I was going to say move him up to bigger and better, but I caught myself there. You never know what you're going to get on Raw or SmackDown. But that really is where he belongs. They closed the show with the wedding of Dexter Lumis and Indy Hartwell. And the wedding was the best part of, I think, not only the best part of the show, but one of the better wrestling weddings that they have ever done. I mean, it was no Billy and Chuck wedding, but I thought it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun watching this. Earlier in the show, Austin Theory returned. We have not seen him on TV in many, many weeks. He's been doing dark matches before Raw and SmackDown. He's another one who I'm sure is main roster bound, possibly in the draft. He'll pop up on one of those two shows. And he brought a guest with him. He brought Damian Priest back to NXT. Damian Priest showed up, and they had to explain to him that Damian is not a real priest. Austin Theory couldn't understand what they were saying. Damian Priest seemed more interested in the open bar. You'll notice he did not come out for the actual wedding. He really was just there for the free booze. They had various members of the NXT roster in the ring to attend the ceremony. They took the ring ropes down. We learned that Dexter Lumis's middle name is Gaylord, which I'm sure was written to get a good laugh out of Vince McMahon. Laugh! Johnny Gargano, he asked Austin Theory at one point if he had the rings, and Theory said, "Well, we're in a ring, silly." So he didn't have the rings, but Ike Minjiro did. He stood up and he opened his sport coat. He's the one who wears the jacket in the ring when he wrestles. He opened his sport coat and there were the rings. And when the priest asked if anybody objects to these two being married, speak now or forever hold your peace, everybody hesitantly raised their hand. At which point Dexter Loomis opened his jacket up and flashed a hatchet. And they all slowly put their hands down. And then Indy read her vows. When it was time for Dexter to do the same, he simply gave a thumbs up gesture like he was Orange Cassidy. The priest couldn't believe it. He said, "You don't have anything to say to this lovely bride?" So Loomis put the priest in a chokehold. He choked him unconscious. Who among us has not wanted to do that? Everybody then started a Regal chant. William Regal was sitting at ringside. They wanted him to stand up and officiate the ceremony. Regal had the best mortified expression on his face that I have seen in a very long time. It's William Regal. His facial expressions are legendary. He could tell a story without saying a word. He didn't want to have any part of this. So finally, Beth Phoenix stepped in to officiate. She says she just got ordained as a minister on the internet last night. Indy says, "I do." And then all eyes turn to Dexter Loomis. And what did I tell you months ago? What did I say on this podcast? This is going to pay off with Dexter Loomis speaking his first words. And sure enough, he says, "I," and everybody leans in. They don't know what he's going to say next. And he says, "Do." And everybody pops huge, including Austin Theory, who had the cheesiest over-the-top reaction to this. It was awesome. Husband and wife, they share a kiss, which really was more Indy doing the kissing, and Loomis just kind of stood there and absorbed it. He absorbed the kiss. A rare happy ending to a wrestling wedding, at least until we find out that Indy has been boning Austin Theory, which gives Vince McMahon that incest storyline he's always wanted. Even though it's not technically incest because they're not really related, but they're sort of treated like brother and sister in this storyline, so that's good enough for the old man. That's about as good as it might get for him. The show closed with Bron Breakker approaching Tommaso Ciampa backstage. As Ciampa was watching the wedding, he was shaking Tommaso's hand out of respect. "Congratulations on becoming the champion." And then there was a lot of staring at each other, and Bron was staring at the belt. There was a lot of staring. There was a lot of heavy breathing. The new NXT is a work in progress. I like the idea of showcasing some new faces that they think have the potential to become big names, but they should not fill the majority of the show with developmental acts. I almost feel like they put too many of them on this show. I think you need a good balance between developmental names that aren't ready yet and more experienced vets. Otherwise, you're just not going to have a very appealing television show. But as with everything, the success or the failure of NXT 2.0 or 3.0 or 4.0 or 5.0 is not going to be decided on Tuesdays. It is going to be determined by what they do with those talents when they eventually start working Mondays and Fridays. That has not changed. And no matter how much I might think Bron Breakker has the potential to be something special or a WrestleMania headliner one day or Von Wagner or how much I really like Hit Row, it won't matter if they get called to the main roster and they get misused. And so in that respect, that hasn't changed. I am still as concerned and worried now as a fan as I was weeks ago. That hasn't changed. Until I see how all of this shakes out, I will continue to have those concerns. I had a few mailbag questions lined up, but we're going to save them for next week because I am slowly starting to lose my voice here. So, surprised I made it this far. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'm also on Instagram. Don't forget about Instagram. @TheSolomonster is my handle on there. I am planning going forward to keep the Dark Side of the Ring reviews separate like I did for the first half of Season 3. Make them, you know, YouTube and then take the audio and push them out separately to the feed if they're long enough. So that's my plan for the Chris Canyon episode. That's coming up Dark Side of the Ring this Thursday. So probably a few days after that, I'll try to get a review knocked out on that. So watch for that. Subscribe to the channel. This is going to be a big week, because we have the Dynamite Grand Slam on Wednesday night. I am going to be live on YouTube as soon as the show goes off the air. So a few minutes after 10 p.m., come on over to the channel. We'll talk about all of the goings-on. And we'll do the same thing after the Rampage Grand Slam on Friday. I don't know if I'm going to be doing a prediction stream, a live stream for Extreme Rules, as far as predictions go. If I do, probably would be Thursday, but at the very least, I will be live after Extreme Rules. That's next Sunday, so I'll talk about that on the podcast next week. I'll promote it then too, but a lot of stuff coming up later on this week. And as I said before, the biggest week, this is going to be the biggest week in AEW history. This is a very important week for them. They have to knock it out of the park. They're going to have all those people in that building. They may well end up with their biggest television audience ever. It is imperative that they deliver, I think, a really good show both on Wednesday and on Friday and build on this momentum that they have. I mean, right now, they are the hot product right now. And at some point, that's going to start to wane. They're going to start to burn out a little bit, but they need to be able to sustain that for as long as possible. And I think what they've done so far building up to this point has been great, and they have put together a hell of a show. It's, like I said, a free pay-per-view, basically. But then what happens on that show and coming out of the show is going to be just as important as everything they've done up to this point. They've put the pieces together. They've brought in Punk. They brought in Danielson, right? They've been building up other younger stars, newer names, MJF and Darby Allin and Hangman Page whenever he's ready to come back. Now, what do they do with those pieces? And also, are they done? Tony Khan has said they're not done with their acquisitions. Might we see another debut at Arthur Ashe Stadium this week? I certainly hope it's not Ric Flair. Timing on that wouldn't be ideal. But it could be somebody else. We'll see. Anyway, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. Join me for the Grand Slam coverage on YouTube on Wednesday and Friday. And until then, I will see you guys very soon. And for 7:23 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
Everybody is freaking out about the new NXT logo. It looks like something out of a cartoon. Yes, it sucks. I am more concerned about the future of that NXT show, what it is going to look like 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now. It is a logo. Who gives a shit? They're talking about completely revamping the brand and the way they recruit talent, and people are freaking out about the fucking logo. Are you people for real? Who cares?
The Solo Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/TheSoloMonster for sound off extras and more. And follow The Solo Monster on Twitter @SoloMonster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solo Monster sounds off.